Morning. So, quite a long passage, and I think Sam sort of put them both together because they both have this, at least appear in the text, under this heading of suffering for Christ. And it was quite, you know, I struggled quite a lot to work out, you know, kind of what to do, you know, and how to kind of how to preach and where to go with this. And part of that is because, Peter. So this is Peter the apostle. You know, he's kind of the impetuous chap in the Gospels, is always kind of jumping in, and it feels like his letter's a bit like that as well. It's this sort of roller coaster ride of ideas and thoughts that come out to his mind, and Mark. Mark, who wrote Mark's Gospel, also is almost certainly helping him to write this as well. And, so there's this real sort of roller coaster of ideas. And the other thing that was quite difficult in kind of coming to this initially is that, especially this idea of suffering for Christ, you know, so the context, you know, as you may recall from other sessions, so it's folk who are here, kind of Asia Minor. It's the Apostle Peter. He's writing to Christians both from a Jewish and a non-Jewish background, and it's probably somewhere around about 64 AD, and they seem to be in some ways in quite a difficult situation. But then you think of, you know, for me, when I think about persecution, there's part of what was kind of difficult about it is sometimes there's this narrative of persecution of Christians in the West, which I think can be a really kind of unhelpful narrative. There's a sense of, it's terrible how Christians are persecuted today and we're not taken seriously and ridiculed. And there's a danger that it becomes a very sort of oppositional, a very sort of confrontational dynamic in which either Christians might kind of withdraw from society, or alternatively become a more sort of reactionary, confrontational thing. You know, something in the same sort of dynamic. We talk about, you know, we're going to touch on martyrdom and so on. So there are also those kind of links to radicalization we see in Islam in the world today as well. It's that same sort of dynamic. So that's part of what, you know, was kind of uncomfortable in going into this. So what I'm actually going to end up talking about mostly is to try and get a little bit under the skin of persecution as it was then and as it exists now, and really try and unpack a little bit about what's going on. So Peter starts off quite positively. Be like-minded, sympathetic, love one another, be compassionate and humble. You know, all good things. We can go with that. Don't repay evil with evil or insult with insult. Repay evil with blessing. For this you were called. So we get there's this very sort of positive, encouraging, pastoral bit as he's starting off, and he gets onto this kind of what appears to be rhetorical question, which invites the answer: no one. Who's going to harm you if you're eager to do good? And you know, that's certainly the sense is there. Well, no one should harm you if you're eager to do good. But it's almost like at this point he kind of remembers, oh, hang on a minute, these people are actually really suffering quite a lot. But even if you should suffer for doing what's right, you're blessed. And of course, as soon as you think about Christians and suffering, then that, you know, kind of his train of thought is now onto Christ's suffering as well. And how, you know, that's, you know, we'll come back to that, I guess, how that's kind of partly a pattern for us. And certainly Jesus provides a very specific example of how people can be harmed for doing good. So if you think of, we'll take two kind of key examples from Jesus' life. So one of the biggest causes of tension between Jesus and the kind of the authorities of the day was about observing the Sabbath. You know, so here's an incident which, again, so this is Mark's Gospel, so this is almost certainly Peter's account of what happened. Jesus said to them, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill? But they remained silent. So this is a chap who's come in, he's got a withered hand. Jesus knows they don't want him to heal him on the Sabbath. And Jesus says to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out and the hand was completely restored. And the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. He heals the man. Result, they go off to plot his murder. So why? What's going on there? Well, we know that one of the things the Pharisees really love is their rules, and they also have a lot of rules. Not only this one obviously is grounded in, sort of Moses, the commandment given to Moses about observing the Sabbath, but they've constructed a whole set of extra rules about exactly how you do that, and they're very keen to live by that set of rules, and very happy to judge by that set of rules, and they're very confident in their own judgment as well. They have no qualms about exercising their judgment in relation to these rules, which tells them with absolute conviction, Jesus is breaking this rule. He cannot be from God. He must be a bad man. Jesus, on the other hand, rather than rules, we see compassionate work backed up with divine power, actual healing flowing through him. And he's very public about, kind of not accepting their rules, about directly, he forces this confrontation. He's trying to win them over. Which is better? I can heal this man. This would be doing good on the Sabbath. Really, can you tell me that that's not what God wants? And he's very popular with the people, which kind of rubs salt into the wound, if you like. So you can see, some of the dynamic that's going on, at least in that situation, where Jesus doing good leads those around him to wish him harm and to actively work towards his harm. Or if we, kind of skip on, take Jesus at his trial. The high priest asked him, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? What does Jesus do? He says, I am. So he tells the truth. He says, yes, I am your Messiah. And what's their response? Okay, that's blasphemy. You deserve to die. So again, similar kind of thing going on. The rules, not only the rules now, but also the sort of political nous. These now are not the Pharisees, these are the Jewish leaders, the people with the political power. They've got the in with Rome, and they know what, politically what's expedient, but equally as happy to take on a role of judgment. And what does Jesus do? Well, he tells the truth. His crime, if such it is to not fit their preconceptions. They're looking for the Messiah, but they can't recognize him here. And he's also not intimidated. He doesn't back down. He just kind of carries through with it. So, jumping back into the passage then, there's just sort of starting to open up a bit about when doing good may actually invite harm. Jumping back into the passage, as we get into the second bit there, where Peter again returns to the same theme, he says, don't be surprised at the fiery ordeal that's come on you to test you. So there seems to be something specific going on in terms of the situation that these Christians are finding themselves in terms of opposition. And there's a pretty good chance that it's got something to do with Nero, who famously fiddled, well, it probably wasn't actually a fiddle, they didn't have violins at that point, but while Rome burned, he stood by, and one of the things which he did do is to scapegoat the Christians as the culprits for the fire of Rome. And why did he do that, or why did that work? Why was that possible? Well, the early believers, at least in some places, the word on the streets about them wasn't particularly complimentary. They obviously didn't join in with the kind of big public pagan ceremonies, and they kind of met in their own sort of homes and places. So in a way, they seemed quite secretive. Not only that, but they loved their brothers and sisters. And so, you know, people took that literally. So people thought they were committing incest in their religious meetings. And they ate Jesus' flesh and drank his blood. They thought they were cannibals as well. You know, literally, these are the things, you know, the rumour on the street was that, you know, this is what the Christians were up to. So they were quite a natural, you know, kind of collective scapegoat for being accused of kind of causing trouble and insurrection. So thinking partly about that, but also sort of stepping back and thinking a bit more broadly about some of the things that lead to that kind of division and that kind of opposition, the whole bunch of different factors, different situations may have more or less of them. You may be able to add your own as well. Where there are visible differences, people who look different, people who sound different, you know, there's kind of a natural line of division or separation. Where one party doesn't understand the other. So in that case, you know, the average Roman citizen in the street has this really, well, to us, you know, sort of bizarre misunderstanding of what the Christians are doing in their religious practice. There may be a sense of threat, and we'll kind of come back to that a little bit in the context of Christians in a moment. That may be sort of a real threat, or it may just be some sort of imagined threat to the status quo. Sometimes, of course, there are, you know, real disagreements between people. You know, so the Christians genuinely did not want to take part in sacrifices to Caesar, you know, as a matter of principle. Beyond that, there may be real conflicts of interest. So you think of some situations in the world today, you know, there are finite resources. Two groups both wish to have those resources. And that's part of the driver for opposition. And obviously, some of the most painful ones are one where it's not just now, but there's a whole history of conflict and a whole, you know, a whole range of events that people can draw on both sides in the past to sort of fuel that sense of division or otherness. So we're thinking kind of mainly about Christians, so or at least certainly religious persecution. So it's worth thinking for a moment what religion is. So in some situations, you know, in the West, it's easy to think about it, you know, just as a set of beliefs. You know, you believe the following things, the following set of claims about the way the world is. And that's one facet of religion. Incidentally, this is a fictional portrayal of a Jewish family from a media program, because, you know, if it's quite an easy way, if you think about how we think about Jews and being Jewish, to see the many facets that religion has. Because religion can also be a shared identity. You know, it's got nothing necessarily to do with exactly what you believe, but it's a way of identifying, of being part of a particular group. And it may also be something which is really a way of life, something which is pervasive in the, you know, the whole of your life. So, you know, in the kind of Enlightenment view, really, you know, Christianity might just be, you know, it's this doctrine. Do you agree to this doctrine? Well, that's it. But it's clearly potentially, and in many situations, actually much more than that. And equally true of any religion. Also, you know, part of a sense of belonging to a bigger group, and something which, at least, I guess we'd say in an ideal world, would shape everything that we did and, you know, inform all aspects of our lives. So given that, you know, sort of broader picture of religion, if you think of the Roman Empire at the time, the Roman Empire was a vast state, assembled from a very, very large number of conquered states, each with their own kind of ethnicities and their own kind of cultures and practices. And one of the, you know, the key challenges that the empire had was to try and bring some sense of common identity to the empire, you know, to have some kind of common sense of being Roman, or the aspiration to be Roman or a citizen. And so the kind of the Roman religious system, which was really kind of a bit of a mishmash of things from all these different places, was very much oriented around these kind of public affirmations of our kind of shared identity, our affiliation to Rome as the Roman Empire. And so in that kind of context, one of the real kind of points of tension between the Christians and the rest of the empire was around participation in these kind of big public sacrifices. So typically the Christians would refuse to do so, and in the same sort of way that we already saw them scapegoated, that would often mean, you know, at least in the common understanding, okay, well, we made all the sacrifices to the gods, but there's still been a drought and the crops have failed. That must be the Christians' fault, because they weren't, you know, they were disrupting our sacrifices and not taking part. So it's that kind of non-conformance, non-compliance with that part of the national, or, you know, the sort of the state identity, which drove quite a lot of the tensions between the empire and the Christians. So, flipping again for a moment, I mean, what does persecution look like? It looks like many different things, and this list obviously is not exhaustive. There's a whole bunch of threats about personal safety. So if we think of persecution of the early Christians, think about them perhaps being executed. You know, that's the most, you know, the highest level threat to personal safety, but it may also include violence against the individual, threats against the individual. It may be more to do with freedom of expression. You know, are you able to take part in worship, for example, or, you know, to express elements of your religious convictions or not? It can extend to your property, destruction or vandalism or confiscation of it. It can extend to your livelihood. Your business may be boycotted. Taxes may be applied unfairly to you. And then perhaps the most pervasive and the hardest one, in the whole kind of social realm. So you may be ostracized, people may refuse to talk to you. You may be kidnapped, forced into marriage in a different kind of religious setting. You may just be insulted in the street. You know, there are so many facets to things which, to those kinds of opposition. But broadly, it may be helpful to just sort of think of them under sort of one broad scale. So in some cases, the sense of oppression is more to do with conformance, coercion, to be like the rest of us. You know, you think that's particularly acute if you're a Christian from a Muslim background. You know, so that it's about, you know, it's a bit like with the Roman example. The problem wasn't the bad things Christians did, but not taking part in the sacrifice. You know, that was the coercion. You must take part in this public sacrifice. On the other hand, it may be actually a sort of direct opposition, punishment or sanction of all those different kinds. And who persecutes? Well, again, obviously that's also quite a complicated picture, and depending on the particular situation, it may be all different kinds of things. So the state. There were a few occasions when the Roman Empire did systematically persecute Christians, but not many at all. So a little bit under Nero, and then one particular couple of period in the kind of early 300s under a couple of emperors. But generally, the Roman Empire was moderately indifferent to Christians, but there are places today, and we'll see some examples in a moment, where the state is a key actor. Sometimes it's society at large. So for us, we might look at public media, you know, that sort of general public sense of how things are and what people say about us. It may be one's neighbours, one's family, the people right around you. It may be particular groups within society, extremist groups, for example. Or it may be any and all of these. So I'll ground it with some examples. We'll come back to the last one when we pray in a bit. So, you know, smallest possible thumbnail sketch, North Korea. So that's very much a state-led thing. So the state institutionalizes worship for the family, and exercises very rigid control over all aspects of life, including religion and religious expression. And it's all part of this kind of enforced national identity. And because Christians don't recognise, you know, that sort of state authority as being the highest authority, then they're considered the enemies of the state. You know, so that's the sort of basic bind that they're put in. And it's because it's, you know, so it's all kind of essentially, well, the initiative is top down, but because it's so pervasive, you know, it really does pervade every level of society, so that, you know, children will literally turn their parents into the authorities if they discover that they are Christians, because, you know, that's what all their friends and their school have told them is the right thing to do. Different kind of example, Saudi Arabia, for example. You think of lots of Islamic majority countries. Not only Islamic majority, but actually an Islamic state. So, which means that religious law, so Sharia law, is not just for the religious community, but it's actually the law of the nation, is Islamic law. And that identification of the religion and the state then leads you to things like, you know, in Saudi it's forbidden to openly practice any faith other than Islam, and conversion from Islam is punishable by death, and things about, obviously laws about blasphemy and so on. The last one, which we'll come back to when we pray in a little bit, is India, which is, I think, quite topical at the moment, because this is one of the ones which is the largest democracy in the world. It's yet another demonstration that democracy is not the solution to all problems. So the Hindu Nationalist Party, BJP, have just won their second national election, and they have a very strong Hindu nationalist agenda, and have been working, you know, kind of systematically to build and assert a Hindu national identity for India. They're a little more sympathetic to what they consider to be sort of locally established or locally birthed religions, so Buddhism and Sikhism, but the sort of the external import, Islam and Christianity, are particularly, you know, seen as confronting or undermining that kind of national identity. So while freedom of religious expression is, you know, is in the constitution and in the law in India, what tends to happen, or seems to be happening increasingly at the moment, is that that sort of popular, you know, the sort of the public environment that moves in that direction, then encourages perhaps extremist nationalist groups within society to undertake attacks or persecution, and then also quite often then the official state authorities do not take action, so do not actually follow up on attacks. And sometimes, you know, think for example of the Dalit subcommunity in India, who are the kind of the lowest members of the caste, the Indian Hindu caste system. They're also, there's a lot of Christians, a lot of Dalits have become Christians as well. And so, in a sense, they both, you know, you kind of import this, the history of conflict and oppression that's sort of embodied in the caste system, but now they're kind of doubly discriminated. They're both Christians and members of the lowest caste, although part of the way this discrimination actually works is that the law in India says that if you become a Christian, well, you can't be in the lowest caste anymore, because that's a Hindu thing. And there's actually various supportive legislation that supports Dalits, but as soon as a Dalit becomes a Christian, they lose those supportive pieces of legislation, because they're not considered Dalits anymore by the law, although, of course, their neighbours still do. So, some of the many faces of persecution as it existed then and as it exists now. I'll kind of round up this first bit, and then there's one other bit which is a little bit different, which I'll touch on at the end. Peter says, "Rejoice in as much as you participate in the sufferings of Christ." Well, there's a sentence to try and unpack, isn't it? Um, there's a bunch of ways, I guess, you could look at that. You know, so it might, you might think, well, is this saying, you know, somehow Jesus' sacrifice, you know, we think the stereotype, you know, the sort of the wireframe sketch that we have of the sort of the nub of Christian faith and Jesus' sacrifice, but, you know, dying for sins and all that. It doesn't, you know, how could we have a specific role in that? Well, I don't think we do really. But if you kind of step back and look at it, sort of a slightly bigger picture, I guess, well, what is the pattern in Jesus' suffering? You know, we've just seen two examples. He's moved by compassion, and he does what he thinks is right, and he's no respecter of meaningless rules. And if the authorities apply pressure to him, he stands strong. And so there's also, you know, the kind of a sense in which in the incarnation, Jesus, you know, kind of he journeys through his life with kind of total integrity, doing the good, and yet, you know, or perhaps even because he's doing that, various parties within society, you know, sort of oppose him and ultimately kill him. And, you know, as it says, you know, as a lamb, you know, before its shearers is silent, you know, and he just kind of accepts it and kind of deals with it. And there's this, you know, so one distinction that some people make is we often live with a model of retributive justice. Someone does something wrong, the right thing to do is to punish them. So the retribution, and that brings justice in the end. But what that certainly doesn't seem to be what Jesus does. That's not how he brings about justice. He brings about justice in what's sometimes described as restorative justice. Somehow, you know, he manages to take all of this suffering and this opposition, including sin, however you want to name it, and he doesn't kind of mirror it back. He doesn't retaliate. He doesn't escalate the violence. But he just walks with it. And in the end, something remarkable happens. So I think perhaps that's, you know, sort of a more helpful way of looking at the way in which we might participate in the suffering of Christ. You know, if and when life does bring us suffering, that comes out of, you know, our attempt to live as well as we can under God. Well, that's, you know, that's just exactly the model that Christ gives us, and our response should be the same. So, as Peter concludes that section that we read, those who suffer according to God's will should, one, commit themselves to their faithful Creator, and two, continue to do good. So just kind of bear with it in a way. Trust God. Do what you can. Do the good that you can do. Now, a little bit like Rachel last week, you know, I was kind of, a lot of that is all very kind of out there, you know, and it's, you know, it's real. It's happening now. It's worth considering. But it's also obviously worth us considering whether any of those same dynamics are going on closer to home, or indeed whether we're more on the perpetrating side of those. So this is my last bit, which is a little bit different. So a question which I was also asking myself is, you know, do we see some of these same things also going on within the church? And obviously, I mean, you could go back into the, you know, the history of religion in England, and you find a lot of that going on. But even very close to home, one particular area that came to mind where quite a lot of people experience, you know, what feels to them at least like quite acute persecution and opposition within the church is one about kind of sexual expression, sexuality and gender. So, you know, for, it's not very many years, obviously, since homosexuality or homosexual acts have been criminal in this country, it's still a crime in many other countries. And a lot of people within churches, you know, kind of struggle with that whole kind of area, you know, because it's, again, you know, perhaps a little bit like the Pharisees, we'd like to have nice simple rules, and a lot of our inherited rules around morality would say, you know, kind of leave us quite uncomfortable or awkward, not really knowing what we're doing in this kind of space. But if you kind of look at those same, you know, checkpoint the same sort of issues that we've touched on in relation to kind of racial, in terms of religious persecution and opposition, visible difference, yeah. Ignorance, lack of understanding, yes, for many of us. A sense of threat, yes, sometimes, you know, we can feel kind of quite threatened by things. Genuine disagreements, yes, some of those as well. And a history of conflict. You know, a lot of the same kinds of dynamics seem to be going on in that same, you know, exactly that same sort of debate. And again, you're looking at those, you know, two different aspects of how this works. So it's not always direct opposition. You know, what can be experienced of persecution can equally be that, you know, the sense of coercion to conform to particular norms. And similarly, you know, those same kinds of things you can see at play in that sort of space. So, you know, so that's my, you know, sort of secondary point for us to reflect on, I guess, is what, whether there are things that we as a church need to kind of wrestle with in that kind of area, or as individuals, perhaps. I guess we would all wish to be inclusive church, but, you know, certainly historically, and probably actually most churches, not all, you know, there are some, you know, very explicitly inclusive churches in the UK now, but in most churches in the UK now, I think, you know, people who identify as LGBTQ, whatever, do not feel included at all. And, so I think there's an interesting challenge for us there on the kind of home ground as well.